From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Larry McMurtry has adapted his prequel to Lonesome Dove into a TV miniseries that begins Sunday. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature an interview with McMurtry, and our TV critic David Bianculli previews the miniseries. Tomorrow is the 108th anniversary of the birth of Irving Berlin. We'll talk about Berlin's songs with biographer Lawrence Berggren. There's a new edition of Berggren's 1990 biography of Berlin. And Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews the new movie, Twister. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Larry McMurtry left his home state of Texas as a young man, but for the past decade, his fiction has helped shape the way Americans perceive the historic frontier. His Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Lonesome Dove, about a cattle drive near the end of the 1800s, was adapted into a very popular TV miniseries. So is the sequel, Streets of Laredo. This Sunday and Monday, you can see a new 5-hour miniseries based on McMurtry's recent prequel to Lonesome Dove, Dead Man's Walk. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with McMurtry. First, our TV critic David Bianculli has a preview of the miniseries, Dead Man's Walk.
Right off the bat, let me clear up two things that may be confusing. Number one, Dead Man's Walk is a Western, and even though it sounds similar, has nothing to do with the recent movie Dead Man Walking. And number two, while Dead Man's Walk is another chapter in the Lonesome Dove story, it's not a sequel. It's a prequel. McMurtry's original Lonesome Dove miniseries, broadcast by CBS in 1989, is a classic and remains to this day the best Western ever made for TV. Robert Duvall was terrific as Texas Ranger Gus McCrae, and Tommy Lee Jones was just as terrific as his quiet best friend, Woodrow Call. Gus died in Lonesome Dove, and Tommy Lee Jones wouldn't play Woodrow again in a sequel, but CBS went ahead and made Return to Lonesome Dove anyway, even though McMurtry didn't write it. Then McMurtry did write his official sequel, Streets of Laredo, and CBS made that too. Meanwhile, somebody else took the character of Newt, Woodrow's bastard son, and presented him in a weekly syndicated TV series called Lonesome Dove: The Outlaw Years. So I can understand all the confusion here. But with this new Dead Man's Walk miniseries, McMurtry himself has taken a giant step backwards, and he tells the story of Gus and Woodrow when they were eager young men out on their first mission as raw Texas Ranger recruits. By going backwards, McMurtry has given us the best TV Western since the original Lonesome Dove. You'd think it'd be dramatically weaker, because we know in advance that Gus and Woodrow, now played by David Arquette and Johnny Lee Miller, have to survive whatever's thrown at them. But McMurtry introduces tons of other characters for whom survival is much less certain, and makes us care about them just as much. One of them is veteran frontier scout Bigfoot Wallace, played perfectly by Keith Carradine. Sitting around the campfire, Bigfoot entertains the new recruits with stories about how best to kill yourself if you're about to be captured by Comanches. Well, maybe entertained isn't the right word, but it sure is riveting.
You could do it with a broken bottle, or even poke a big mesquite thorn in there, if that's all you got available. You want to cut two or three times, though. That way you bleed to death before they get a chance to do much torture.
Mate, I'll shoot myself in the head if I got time.
Well, that can go wrong, too. Don't be sticking no gun in your mouth unless it's a shotgun.
Why not? It's hard to miss your head with a gun in your mouth.
No, it ain't. That bullet could ricochet off a tooth. Come out your ear.
The strength of Dead Man's Walk is the same secret weapon used in Lonesome Dove. The drama makes it clear that the Wild Wild West was precisely that, and that death can visit at any time, in almost any form. Remember the first time you saw Psycho and were stunned when Janet Leigh, the apparent star of that movie, was killed after the first reel? Well, Dead Man's Walk does that to you all the way through. Danger pops up when you least expect it, even when you know to expect it when you least expect it. In Dead Man's Walk, we learn, more than anything else, why Woodrow becomes as quiet and distant as he does. The next prequel, I guess, is Gus's turn. and McMurtry already has said he plans to write another adventure about their early years. Meanwhile, I have one question. What do you call a sequel to a prequel? A pre-sequel? A C-prequel? I don't know. Maybe it's a midquel.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Larry McMurtry's Dead Man's Walk begins Sunday evening. The Old West is just one of the subjects McMurtry has written about. He's also the author of The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment, which were adapted into films, and Horseman Passed By, which was the basis of the film HUD. I spoke with McMurtry last year. He told me that he created some of the Lonesome Dove characters in the 70s when he wrote a screenplay for The Streets of Laredo. That movie wasn't made, but James Stewart, Henry Fonda, and John Wayne had considered taking starring roles.
Streets of Laredo, the script, was not a trail-driving story. It was a story of a kind of last adventure. It was kind of an end of the West story about a last adventure between three old guys, or almost old guys, who had been buddies throughout the sort of golden days of the Old West, had stumbled into this adventure, which was not successful, which is why the actors sort of drew away from it. Stuart, Fonda, and Wayne, they didn't want to be old, and they didn't want to be... If they were old and they were in an adventure, they wanted it to be a successful adventure, and it wasn't. So I got it back. I piddled with it for a considerable while. I didn't really write it until I wrote the screenplay in the early 70s. I didn't really write the novel until the mid-80s. And I suppose, of course, I come from ranching stock. I had nine uncles who were cattlemen. My father was a cattleman. Some of my uncles were old enough to participate a little bit in the last years of the trail driving era, which only lasted one generation. The reason there were trail drives is because there were no railroads to transport the cattle to market. As soon as there were railroads, it became very inefficient to drive cattle hundreds and thousands of miles, and of course they stopped. But the myth of the cowboy, as we have it today, came out of that roughly 20-year period, 20, 25 years after the Civil War, in which the range cattle industry suddenly sort of flowered, kind of like the oil industry did a bit later, in which it was necessary to get all the cattle in South Texas, and millions of them, north to the markets. And it's very different from ranch life, which is not particularly romantic and not particularly cinematic. So most of the myth of the cowboy came out of that one generation of trail drivers, and it was perfectly possible, since cowboys were often very young, 13, 14, 15 years old. My uncles all left home before they were 14 and became cattlemen. Perfectly possible for one boy to have gone up the trail with the first herds in, say, the mid-60s, right after the Civil War, and the last herds in the mid-80s or a little bit later. So it was all over in a very brief period of time. And the fact that it lasted such a short while lent a certain romance and a certain poignancy to it.
Did your uncles ever talk about how dirty and smelly it was to ride with cattle?
Well, sure, they did. I mean, I grew up with cattle, so they didn't really have to tell me anything about dirty and smelly. They certainly are dirty and smelly. It's one reason I wouldn't have wanted to be a cowboy. Also, they're very stupid. I didn't want to be enslaved all my life to animals as stupid as cattle.
So you grew up on a cattle ranch?
Yeah, on a small ranch in north central Texas, just below the Red River, near a town called Wichita Falls, about 100 miles west of Dallas, Fort Worth, northwest.
Did your father expect you to keep on the ranch?
I think he might have liked it. It was evident pretty early that this was not going to be my skill. It was also, my father was not dumb, and he saw that the cattle business had already ceased to be a viable family business unless you own immense, immense amounts of land, which we didn't. And even my uncles, who left home early and got to the Panhandle when it was open range and ended up with very substantial amounts of land, couldn't survive as ranchers. Ranching is an industry almost entirely supported by oil or by other money. You know, the ranchers now are doctors and lawyers and architects and people who have gotten rich in other professions. My father foresaw this as early as I can remember, which is by the mid-40s. He saw that the amount of land that we had would he made a decent living throughout his life He was very, very skilled, but he was still in debt for 55 years. And he had four children. There's no way that if you divide that ranch by four that it can make a living for anybody. It wouldn't make a living for anybody even if it wasn't divided by four. And that was foreseen by my father very early on.
Larry McMurtry is my guest, and he's the author of Lonesome Dove, Streets of Laredo, the new book in the Lonesome Dove trilogy, Dead Man's Walk. He also wrote The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment. What was the life that you imagined you wanted when you were growing up in Texas, realizing that you wanted to get off the cattle ranch and you wanted to get out of the small town?
Well, I wanted a life in literature, essentially, and I realized that quite young. I didn't imagine that I would become a writer, but I knew that I could become a reader. And so reading has always drawn me from the age of five or six. It drew me out of the small town. It drew me to Houston, to Rice University. And it was sort of the strongest motivating factor for most of my youth. And as it turned out, like many readers, I began to try it for myself to see if I could do this thing that had given me so much pleasure. And I was lucky and successful. But it was reading that that took me off the range.
Were there bookstores around when you were growing up?
No, I had almost no books until I got to Rice. I did have a cousin who, as he was going off to war in 1941, I was like five at the time, stopped by the ranch house on his way to what turned out to be the Pacific Theater and left me some books, 19 books, in fact, just a bunch of sort of the normal boys' books of the time. And that was my library for quite a spell. There were some books in the high school library in Archer City, but not a whole lot. And I didn't really have adequate literary resources until I was a college student. Perhaps that's one reason I'm a rare bookseller as well as an author, and I have three rare bookstores, one in Washington, D.C., one in my hometown, and one in Tucson, Arizona.
When you started writing books about the Old West, was your idea to further the myth, to debunk the myth of the West, or revise the myths of the West?
You know, I didn't start really writing books about the Old West. I think Lonesome Dove was my 10th novel. Most of my books were set in the contemporary West, and still are. And in fact, in my fiction, I think I've written 19 novels, and one with my collaborator Diana Osana, and of those 19, only about four of them deal with the Old West. Mostly I've dealt with contemporary Western life, a la Terms of Endearment, a la The Last Picture Show, or the book called Horseman Passed By that became the movie HUD. I thought that the Western myth, or the myth of the cowboy, is very powerful. I thought that Lonesome Dove was, in a way, a critique of it. Because I grew up with cowboys. I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them. And I know something of their limitations, having grown up with them. So I didn't set out to write a book which glorified the myth of the West. I didn't particularly set out to write a book that debunked it either. You know, I was telling a story of three men who had been, friends for a long time, who got caught up in an adventure, and the book was a description of that adventure and its consequences.
Give us an example of something in the story that you see as a critique of the myth of the West.
Well, for example, the scathing denunciation that Clara Allen makes of Captain Call when he arrives at her house with Gus's body, when she tells him why she didn't marry Gus, although he was her great love, because she didn't feel that she could hold Gus, that she didn't feel that there was any room for a woman in a domestic relationship in Gus and Call's life. It's not that she felt that they hated women, it's just that they simply didn't give them their due. I think that's pretty severe, and that is redeemed to some extent in Streets of Laredo by the fact that Captain Call's old corporal, P.I., settles down and has a successful family life. But that didn't happen during the golden years of the Old West. This is a post-golden years story. takes place, say, in the 1890s, almost the turn of the century, when, and I think that I think that's a true criticism. I think that women had a terrible time in the early West. Many of them went berserk, and I think that it was a masculine culture, maybe of necessity, but it was a masculine culture and to some extent crude, to some extent fascistic, certainly not welcoming to women.
Well, one of the main characters in your series, Lorena, is, she's a prostitute during some
she's
of the
a, Yeah, she's a prostitute, and she's a whore in Lonesome Dove. And
she's kind of forced into it, really. I mean,
well, there's a character, strangely enough, in Dead Man's Walk, when they're debating, two men are talking about a woman named Matilda Jane Roberts, who was a whore known as the Great Western. And one of the characters remarks on her origin. She came into the West when she was 14, and both her parents died trying to get from St. Louis to Santa Fe or somewhere along the trail. And she became a whore to survive. And one of the characters says there wasn't no room for church-going women in the West in those days, just room for whores, and a lot of them didn't survive. And that's true enough. You know, my grandmother was a pioneer woman, and the West was sort of unsettleable until after around 1875, simply because the Indian Wars were still raging intensely, and my own grandparents paused in their Western migration at a safe line in Northwest Texas. And lived there for 10 years. They didn't go any farther west because they wouldn't have survived the Comanches, very likely, if they had. And then when the Comanches were finally subdued, more or less, in 1874, when their horse herd was destroyed, my grandparents went on to the place where they raised their family and where, in fact, I have the ranch house now, about 100 miles farther west into the Comancheria after it became safe.
My guest is Larry McMurtry, author of the Lonesome Dove trilogy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Larry McMurtry is my guest, and his books include Lonesome Dove, Streets of Laredo, and Dead Man's Walk. He also wrote Terms of Endearment and The Last Picture Show. Did the place in Texas that you grew up in resemble the small town that you wrote about in The Last Picture Show?
Well, it was. That's where The Last Picture Show was filmed. The unusual circumstance of having seen one of my stories filmed in the place where it would have happened. The Last Picture Show and Texasville were both filmed in the small town of Archer City, Texas, which is where I grew up. The town is now sort of slightly confused. It's been so much fiction touched on it. It doesn't really know whether it's fact or fiction. And sometimes when I go home, I feel like I'm living in my own theme park. You know, they have restaurants called Texasville, and it's rather odd. I've inundated that little town with fiction, and you know, most people think that they must be some character in one of the books. They're not quite sure which, and yeah, it's unusual.
That's funny because I think the reaction to The Last Picture Show was pretty bad when it was first published. The reaction in your town because of the sexuality in the book.
That's a little overblown, actually. That's because journalists have to have something to write about, and the Baptist minister, indeed, was offended by the movie and one or two other people in town, but in fact, a lot of people in the town worked on the movie and saw what was happening. A lot of, and you know, even then, in 1971, it brought $3 or $4 million, it brought about, you know, $1 million into the town in a time like that. That county, which I suppose was cattle country when my grandparents stopped there in 1880, was definitely the oil patch by then, and it depends upon the fluctuations in oil prices, not cattle prices. And the cattle prices haven't amounted to anything for hardly in my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old. It's the oil patch, and when the oil when the oil business is up, it's it flourishes a little bit. But I've been buying building after building and putting books in them. The townspeople, I think, are slightly alarmed, but in fact, nobody but me wants those buildings. And, you know, the town is down to a hardware store and a drugstore. Hmm. Doesn't have a hospital anymore. And it has a couple of filling stations, a hardware store and a drugstore, you know, and an abstract company and a bank, and that's about it. And if there's any other services in Archer City, they're oil-related services, not cattle.
Well, you worked hard to get out of your town and to move to the city. Didn't you eventually move back to the town you
Well,
grew
I have a I have a home there, but I'm pretty much and I have a very nice home there, and I go there, and I have a bookstore there which engages me a great deal. Building a million book shop is a lot of fun, but of course I also have a place, and I still have a place in Washington D.C. I have a little place in L.A. and a little place in Tucson. I have a kind of tri-coastal life, in a sense, and I've had it for a long time. I went to Washington, D.C. in 69, and since then, you know, I've been kind of all over the map. I get to Archer City a few days, maybe a week, a month, and then live in my big house, and the rest of the time I'm either running bookstores in D.C. or Tucson, or I'm writing movies in Los Angeles or something. I don't just sit there.
You know, I was thinking maybe we'd end the interview with a song by your son James, who's a singer-songwriter. Do you have a favorite of his you'd like us to play?
The song called Level Land.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a very good talk.
Larry McMurtry, the miniseries based on his Lonesome Dove prequel, Dead Man's Walk, begins Sunday. The novel will be published in paperback next month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Flatter than a tabletop, makes you wonder why they stopped here. Wagon must have lost a wheel, or they lacked ambition one. In the great migration west, separated from the rest, though they might have tried their best, they never caught the sun. So they sunk some roots down in this dirt to keep from blowing off the earth. They built a town right here, and when the dust had all but cleared, they called it Level Land. Right now, Level Land.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The great and prolific songwriter Irving Berlin couldn't read or write music and was a poor pianist. Coming up, we discuss Berlin with his biographer Lawrence Berggren, and Lisa Schwartzbaum reviews the new movie Twister.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the 108th anniversary of Irving Berlin's birth. He left us with an extraordinary number of great songs, catchy songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band, Puttin' on the Ritz, and I Love a Piano, anthems like God Bless America, White Christmas, and Easter Parade, ballads like How Deep is the Ocean and What'll I Do, waltzes like Always, cheerful songs like Isn't It a Lovely Day, and brooding songs like Let's Face the Music and Dance. Lawrence Berggren started a biography of Berlin a couple of years before Berlin died in 1989 at the age of 101. Berlin had become a recluse, estranged from friends and family. It had been 30 years since he spoke to the press. He would not authorize Berggren's biography or grant him an interview, but Berggren did speak to over 200 of Berlin's friends and colleagues. I spoke with Berggren in 1990 when his biography was published. That book, As Thousands Cheer, has just been republished by DeCapo Press. The music industry was very different when Irving Berlin started writing songs at the beginning of the century. I asked Berggren what the place of the songwriter was then.
Well, the songwriter was far more important than he is today. There was Tin Pan Alley. That was on West 28th Street in Manhattan. There was no Hollywood. There was no radio. There were no phonographs or only very primitive home recording devices. So the songwriter and sheet music and music publishing was all of those popular entertainment industries rolled up into one. Tin Pan Alley was originally intended to become the providence of immigrant groups arriving in New York, first the Irish and later on the Eastern European Jews, of whom Irving Berlin was one. Of course, his real name was Israel Berlin. He was the son of a cantor and had come over to this country when he was five. So to become a songwriter was instantly to place yourself in the mainstream of American popular culture.
Okay, so these were the days before radio, before records.
Right.
There was sheet music. How were songs sold?
Songs were sold in department stores such as Woolworth's especially and other big chains. They were sold in music stores. The home entertainment center wasn't a television or a radio. It was the piano. Getting a piano was a great big event. And composers inevitably composed their songs to be performed on the piano. And it meant that it was a much more participatory form of popular entertainment. Today, we're used to being completely passive, to listening. But if you wanted to have popular entertainment in your home at that time, someone had to play the piano at least a little bit, and someone had to sing along.
Now, Irving Berlin got his start as a song plugger. What did that mean?
Well, what that meant was he plugged other people's songs. He worked in vaudeville theaters. And when it was time for a song to come around, he would stand up in the crowd and as if spontaneously, although he wasn't fooling anybody, he would sing out the chorus and try and get the audience to sing along with him. It was sort of the equivalent of an opera claque.
And this would make the song seem really contagious so people would want to run out and buy the sheet music.
It was like being a cheerleader, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, songs were usually owned by the publisher at that time, but when Irving Berlin started writing songs, he eventually started publishing them himself. He must have been very savvy about this.
He was always a very savvy and very careful businessman. This was part of the reason for his success. It wasn't just musical genius. There were a few songwriters, such as Harry Von Tilzer, who was an early mentor of his, who made the leap from being a humble songwriter to being a publisher, an entrepreneur, and they made far more as a publisher than they ever did as a songwriter, just getting a pittance. Berlin was keenly aware of the example of Stephen Foster, whom he considered the great American songwriter, who died virtually penniless. And Berlin was determined not to repeat that example in his own life. So as soon as he was able to, he started his own music publishing company to control his copyrights and royalties and to publish his own songs. He also published songs by other songwriters as well, and what was then known as race music or black music. There was a special division for that.
Let's get to one of Berlin's songs. This is the song that established him. It's the first song that was a hit, and it was called My Wife's Gone to the Country. Would you like to say something about this song?
Berlin had great affection for this song because it was his first big hit. It was even before, it was a year before Alexander's Ragtime Band in 1910. And the idea came to him when he walked into a barber shop one night, and he heard a friend of his exclaiming with delight that his wife had gone away to the country for the summer, leaving him alone to frolic in the city by himself. Berlin thought this was a great idea for a chorus. My wife's gone to the country, and wrote the song. And it was so popular that a newspaper asked him to write some extra verses for it, which presumably probably don't appear on your recording. He went and wrote 200 extra, just to give an idea of the fertility of his mind and the rapidity of his the way he worked. He was a very hard worker.
Well, we've got a 1910 recording of My Wife's Gone to the Country featuring Harry Carlton and his orchestra.
When Mrs. Brown told hubby, I just can't stand the heat. Please send me to the country, dear, I know it would be a treat. Next day his wife and family were seated on a train. And when the train had started, Brownie shouted this refrain. My wife's gone to the country, hurrah, hurrah. She thought it best I need a rest, that's why she went away. She took the children with her, hurrah, hurrah. I don't care what becomes of me, my wife's gone away. My wife's gone to the country. Oh, I am going to enjoy myself.
Lawrence Bergen, why do you think that was such a hit?
Well, I think it struck a nerve. It had a risque overtone to it, and many men could relate to it instantly. It was comic, and it was a novelty song. It was published just before the summer was coming up in the spring, and people went out and got it, and it became a hit song for the summer of 1910.
Just to give a sense of the money, this was before Irving Berlin was publishing his own songs, and you say he made $6,000 from this song.
That's right.
And his publisher made $30,000.
That's right. He was earning just a couple of cents per copy himself, and when he realized how much his publisher was making, he decided he had to become a publisher himself eventually.
Now, Irving Berlin really knew how to tie into the times, and a great early example of that is how he tied into the ragtime craze.
Yes, of course, ragtime had peaked slightly before he came along, and it was mainly black musicians. There were a few white ragtime artists as well. The craze was dying out, and then he revived it by bringing it into the mainstream and adapting it to a Tin Pan Alley formula. Of course, one of the peculiar things about Alexander's ragtime band is that it's not a ragtime song. It's not written in ragtime. There's only a little bit of ragtime in it. What made the song sell was using that buzzword, ragtime, in the title. It's actually a march.
Well, you say Alexander's Ragtime Band was really a march. Now, I'd like to play a kind of very march-like version of it, recorded in 1911, a year after the song was written. And then let's contrast that to another version sung by Bessie Smith. That's Bessie Smith, and before that we heard the Victor Military Band. I think that really gives a nice sense of how flexible his songs were.
That Bessie Smith, she always sends chills up and down my spine. She's fabulous. Of course, he wrote that song first as an instrumental, and it flopped. And he shelved it for a while, and he wrote some lyrics for it and tried it again. And then it caught on, not in New York where most of these songs did, but in Chicago where Emma Karras sang it. And it worked its way back east gradually.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Lawrence Bergreen. His biography of Irving Berlin has just been republished. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lawrence Berggren, author of the Irving Berlin biography, As Thousands Cheer. Berlin started writing for movies, and you say this was at a time when Tin Pan Alley basically sold out to the Hollywood studios. The studio actually bought a lot of the music publishing companies?
That's right. Well, it was the Depression coming, and what happened was many of the Tin Pan Alley publishers, which had grown very quickly during the teens and 20s, found themselves overextended, short of cash. It's a familiar story. And the Hollywood studios, which were then just beginning to blossom, came along, and of course they needed music for the talkies, and they began buying first the songs, then they decided to buy the companies as well. Almost all of them were bought up. Tin Pan Alley became an adjunct of Hollywood, and West 28th Street was quiet. There was only one major music publisher who was a holdout, and that was Irving Berlin, Inc.
Why did he hold out?
That was the strength of Berlin's character. He wanted to stand alone. He wanted control over his musical destiny and over himself. He had nothing else he could rely on. He was used to relying on his own wits to survive. And he felt if he could only ride out the Depression, then his copyrights, the value of them, the musical copyrights, which were then depressed, would eventually go up.
Well, I'm sure he was right about that.
Yes.
Well, even though he didn't sell out his company, he did do a lot of work for Hollywood.
Yes. Oh, yes, he did. He was eager to write for films. It took him years to break in, though. He had one flop after another. First, there were songs such as Marie that were used in silence. Then he began writing scores. His first major effort was a movie called Puttin' on the Ritz, which was the centerpiece, of course, was the wonderful song Puttin' on the Ritz. This starred the vaudevillian Harry Richmond. However, it was a terrible movie, and it flopped. It wasn't until Top Hat, with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, his score for that, which contained the fabulous Cheek to Cheek, that he really scored. And no one forgot all the earlier tentative efforts of his. And from then on, his name was gold in Hollywood.
How are Berlin and Astaire put together in a movie?
Well, they were put together by the producer, Pandro S. Berman, who had fabulous taste. He told me that he had been dying to put these two together. And also, Berlin and Astaire had a great deal in common. They had both come up through vaudeville, and they were both highly dedicated and intense perfectionists. So I think the high standards that they set for themselves allowed them to have a very good working relationship.
Well, let's hear one of the really beautiful songs from the movie Top Hat. And this is Cheek to Cheek, sung by Fred Astaire, recorded in 1935.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak.
Gosh, I love that. you say that Irving Berlin said that he'd rather have Fred Astaire introduce a song than any other singer.
Yes, that's right.
I can certainly understand why.
Well, he loved the way that Astaire kind of combined singing and speaking at the same time. He put a little jaunty hopping rhythm in there, and Berlin felt he had extraordinary sensitivity to his music.
Would you tell the story of how Moss Hart once reacted when he had Irving Berlin demonstrate one of his new songs?
I'd be glad to. This was something that happened to Berlin throughout his career. Like many songwriters, Berlin was a terrible performer. His voice was high, it was reedy. You would have to say this in his favor, though. He had absolutely perfect pitch. However, when he sang one of his songs, they sounded terrible. When he was writing the score for his famous review of called As Thousands Cheer in 1932, from which I took the title of my book, in 1933, rather, he began to sing some of the songs, such as Heatwave for Moss Hart, who was appalled. Here was the great Irving Berlin, and he was sitting at the piano and singing, and Hart thought the songs sounded tinny, they sounded empty, they sounded like nothing. He got very, very worried. Hart was a worrywart. Finally, he said, "Irving, would you please sing Cheek to Cheek, or All Alone, or several other of his classics?" And Berlin sang the others, and they sounded just as terrible, and Hart found that very reassuring, that he knew he had some hit songs on his hands, as soon as he could get them to real performers.
Well, not only couldn't Berlin sing very well, he wasn't a very convincing pianist either.
Well, no, that was one of the things that intrigued me about him, was the paradox of our nation's greatest and most successful songwriter being unable to read or write music. And I think that that was an astonishing story. He used a couple of ways of getting around this limitation. And one was the use of a musical secretary who took down the notation for him. The other was the use of a prepared piano, which could shift keys at the touch of a lever, which was a fairly common invention when Berlin was a young man. And whenever he did try to take formal music lessons or piano lessons, he tried several times, it was a disaster. And it made him feel self-conscious and got in the way of his composing. And finally, people would tell him, "Irving, just stick with doing it the way you're doing."
Lawrence Berggren is my guest, and he's written a new biography of Irving Berlin called As Thousands Cheer. Let's get Irving Berlin back from movies to Broadway. One of Berlin's most famous, most celebrated musicals was the 1946 Annie, Get Your Gun. Berlin wasn't supposed to be the composer who wrote this.
That's right. He was not the first choice. It was Jerome Kern who was supposed to write this. Rodgers and Hammerstein, who were much better known for South Pacific, were then becoming producers as well, and they wanted Kern to write it. Kern somewhat reluctantly came back to New York from Hollywood to begin work on the score, and he suddenly collapsed on the pavement of Manhattan and died several days later. Afterwards, the backers of the show began scrambling for someone else who would be American enough to write the story of this unlettered sharpshooter, inevitably, they settled on Berlin. Of course, Berlin was known not only as a brilliant songwriter, but as a giant ego, and they were afraid they might have to turn over the show lock, stock, and barrel to him, which they weren't prepared to do. Berlin gave ground a little bit, and stopped insisting on having his name in the title as Irving Berlin's Annie, Get Your Gun, and to write a traditional score. And it was his most successful score. It was filled with one hit after another. I've Got the Sun in the Morning and the Moon at Night, There's No Business Like Show Business, and six or seven others.
It's amazing in a way that show business' greatest anthem, There's No Business Like Show Business, came from a musical about Annie Oakley.
That's right. We tend to think of that song now as being very bombastic and very self-celebrating, but in the context of the original show where it appeared, there was just a small group of three or four performers who sang it. It was slightly poignant. It was almost a self-parody, and it didn't have that larger-than-life quality that we tend to find intimidating today, and that made it a far more charming song, I think, in its original incarnation.
Why don't we hear it?
The cowboys, the wrestlers, the tumblers, the clowns, the roustabouts that move the show at dawn. The music, the spotlights, the people, the towns, your baggage with the labels pasted on. The sawdust and the horses and the smell. The towel you've taken from the last hotel. There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show.
There's no business like show business. From the cast recording of the 1966 revival of Annie, Get Your Gun. Irving Berlin's career
kind of headed downwards after this musical, didn't it?
Well, by then he was getting older. Of course, even in his late 50s, he had managed to hang on far longer than most songwriters, who often burned out when they were very young indeed in their 20s. So already he had an extraordinary track record. His songs were still good in Hollywood. He had one or two more successes on Broadway, especially Call Me Madam, which also starred Ethel Merman a few years later. But it's true, then he began losing his self-confidence, losing his touch, and unfortunately the forces which gradually overtook him were beginning to form.
Well, we've only had time to talk about a really small part of Irving Berlin's life and songs. But I thank you very much for bringing that small part to life for us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Terry.
Lawrence Berggren recorded in 1990 after the publication of As Thousands Cheer, his biography of Irving Berlin. It's just been republished by DeCapo Press. Here's Irving Berlin's 1929 song, Puttin' on the Ritz, sung by Fred Astaire.
Puttin' on the Ritz, puttin' on the Ritz, puttin' on the Ritz, puttin' on the Ritz. Have you seen the well-to-do up and down Park Avenue on that famous thoroughfare with their noses in the air? High hats and arrow collars, white spats and lots of dollars, spending every dime for a wonderful time. Now if you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Puttin' on the Ritz. Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes and cutaway coat, perfect fits. Puttin' on the Ritz. Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper, come let's mix, where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts. Puttin' on the Ritz.
Coming up, a review of the new film Twister. This is Fresh Air. To make Twister, a new thriller about killer tornadoes, actress Helen Hunt, who usually co-stars with Paul Reiser on the NBC sitcom Mad About You, endured cuts, bruises, seared corneas, and a possible concussion in the service of art. Yet, says film critic Lisa Schwartzbaum, what fills the screen in this big-budget production, filled with killer special effects, is mostly a lot of wind.
Finally, the first big movie of the summer. And you know what that means? Big special effects. In Twister, which is all about the awesome power of tornadoes, you've got houses that fly through the air, gigantic rig trucks that zigzag around like kites, and, my personal favorite, cows that appear to be jumping over the moon. Now, I'm a sucker for airborne cows, and ever since Speed had me screaming in a movie theater 2 summers ago, I've looked forward to Hollywood's warm-weather roster of thrill-packed, action-jammed, big-budget movies for their bangaroo adrenaline rush and for the chance to get away from drama starring Ricky Lake. But there's a downside to this addiction. Now we need more thrills to keep us occupied. Dutch movie maker Jan de Bont, who directed Twister, learned when he directed Speed that the way to grab the audience's attention is to slam us in the gut immediately, either with a bomb wired to an elevator or a cyclone on the prairie, then dole out the action sequences like pep pills, and then, just when we think we've seen it all, add a final catastrophe. Well, Twister, which was made, as all the ads make mighty sure we know, by Steven Spielberg's production company and written by Jurassic Park biggie Michael Crichton and his wife, has got all that. The storms come tumbling one after the other, chased by Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton as Joe and Bill Harding, obsessed scientists and, for romance's sake, estranged husband and wife. The couple are intent on launching a meteorological gizmo they've invented called Dorothy. Get it? That releases data-gathering sensors into the core of a tornado funnel, sensors that may make for better weather warning. And to do so, they and their equally obsessed scientific team need to put themselves in the path of danger, which they do, over and over. But here's the problem. Big and fast are not enough. As mesmerizing as the sights and sounds of tornadoes are, action thrillers also need tension. They need characters we care about with passions we believe. They need conflict. They need evil against which good can triumph. Nature isn't bad, it's amoral. So as Dennis Hopper said in Speed, what do you do? Twister's weak solution is to introduce Cary Elwes as a slick, commercially funded storm chaser and former team member who steals the Dorothy idea, staffs his own team, and competes for publicity, racing around in a menacing black vehicle that looks like a Darth Vader helmet on wheels. But how can one guy in a van compete with the heavens? He's puny stuff. We're also meant to understand that Jo is obsessed because of a lethal cyclone she survived as a little girl, and that her husband is obsessed because, well, we never do understand why. He just likes wind, I guess. And that's the other thing. Everybody in this film loves danger. No one is afraid. I've seen amateur tornado footage, and the real fear you hear in the background is chilling. Here, what you hear is a lot of wind, a lot of rumbling music, and a lot of yelling while driving. Listen to Joe guiding Bill as he drives through a storm that has tossed a bunch of tractors into the air.
Debris! Dusty, we have debris!
Debris!
Right! Left! Right! Left!
What now?
I have no idea.
Ah, country roads. In Twister, plenty of folks talk about the weather, and a couple actually try to do something about it. Plenty of stuff smashes and crashes and collapses and whips around. But for a movie that stars acts of God, this work of mortals provides relatively little liftoff. Oh well, it's summertime. Up next, Mission Impossible.
Lisa Schwartzbaum is a film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the FBI tracked the Unabomber. We talk with former FBI unit chief and serial crime expert John Douglas. He originated the FBI's Unabomber profile and co-wrote the new book, Unabomber. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.